Today on Maine Calling, the world of pipe organs, part of our Passions and Pastimes series. When you think of organ music, what comes to mind? A scary old movie? Or maybe a Sunday morning church service and feeling transported as sunlight streams in through stained glass windows? Or perhaps you've been to a Kochmar organ concert at Portland City Hall and remember feeling your whole body tremble when the organist pulls out all the stops. The pipe organ is a remarkable instrument, and Maine hosts a community of organ aficionados, builders, restorers, musicians, and collectors. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll meet some of them. Plus, we'll learn about the history of the pipe organ, how it works, and why people are so passionate about this king of instruments. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is unmistakable, the grand and distinctive sound of organ music. Playing the organ is something that has been done since before the time of Jesus Christ. We're going to learn about the history of the organ and learn about pipe organs from those dedicated to playing, building, and appreciating these unique musical instruments. This show is part of our Passions and Pastimes series. Joining me, James Kennerly, who is a concert organist, conductor, composer, and vocalist, and the municipal organist for the Kochmar organ. David Wallace, also here, senior partner of David E. Wallace and Company, Pipe Organ Builders, and Nick Wallace, junior partner of David E. Wallace and Company. He is David's son. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you had any memorable experiences hearing or seeing a pipe organ? What does organ music mean to you? Send an email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. So welcome to all of you. We will have some organ music popping up during this hour, and that's going to be really fun. But let's start with you, James. I think organs are most often associated with churches. But I think that even people who know organ music, who love organ music, maybe don't know much about the pipe organ. Give us some basics. What makes an organ a pipe organ, and at the very basic level, because I've done some reading this morning and I know it's not simple, how do they work?
So the pipe organ, as its name implies, is built of pipes. It's an acoustic instrument, and because every pipe produces a single pitch, every single key that you have on the keys, or the foot pedals that we play with our feet, they all have their own pipe. And so the organ is, first of all, big. And when you walk into a church or a concert hall, you're struck by how physically imposing the pipe organ is. And that's kind of a visual clue to what it's going to sound like, because the sound of the organ is unlike anything else. It's more impressive, I think, than a symphony orchestra. It can be more intimate than a single solo voice. And so the pipe organ, for me, and I know many of our fans, sort of encapsulates every single a possible range of emotions, from the quietest shimmer of a sound to the most impressive kind of godlike booming bass notes. And so that's what I really think makes the organ fantastic.
James, I read that the largest organs can span 9 octaves. Is that the case with the Kochmar organ, which you play?
Well, I have never actually tested the exact number of octaves, but I'd guess, and we can ask our organ experts, it's probably more than that.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, okay. David's piping in here, pardon the pun.
Yes. Kochmar, yes. Kochmar in particular has one set of pipes that has 96 notes in it. That's indeed true, but it's not that you need 96 keys on the keyboard. You take a 61-note chunk out of one part of it, you move up an octave, take out another 61-note chunk. But all total, that set of pipes has 96 pipes in it.
Oh, my goodness. Well, so we'll turn to you now, David. You know pipe organs inside and out, and you build them. And I'm going to take a step back and ask you, this is a very, very niche job you have. How did you get into your career? How did you get involved with actually making and restoring pipe organs?
Well, it was kind of a default all the way along. At 7 years old, my father took my brother and I to Kochmar concerts, so the bug bit. We had an old Tracker organ in our church when I was growing up, the bug bit. And even after a career in the Air Force and a college education to become an earth science teacher, I ended up getting involved with Friends of the Kochmar 40 years ago. So the bug bit permanently at that point. And in the effort to try and bring the Kochmar back to life, I found myself fully involved in organ work. But it goes back a little bit to when I was in college. I did an apprenticeship in organ restoration and organ building. So I had a toolbox of skills to go along with it when the Kochmar group said, "Can you fix this?" And 43 years later, I'm still there fixing it.
But that's not the only organ. Nick, I want to reach out to you and ask you, tell me about some of the people around the state of Maine you work with. Are these predominantly church organs, or are there organ collectors who have organs in their homes?
We do have a couple of clients who are, you know, private individuals who have organs in their homes. And those are kind of dotted around the state, but the vast majority of our clients, you know, in the tuning and maintenance side of our company, most of them are churches, but there are, there's the Kochmar, which is a, you know, performance institution, but also we take care of the organs at all of the universities and colleges in the state. So those are the non-religious institutions. So there's a good mix, but it's mostly churches. Is the predominantly
James,
what they're...
Yeah, where does Maine stand on the map of the pipe organ universe?
So people never believe me when I say this. We had a tour yesterday with lots of people coming into Merrill Auditorium, hearing the organ, some for the first time. And when I tell them this is one of the biggest, most impressive, most significant pipe organs, musical instruments, not just in the country, in the world, people look at me, say, "You must be kidding." But I think of the pipe organ, or I think of the Kochmar organ, a little bit like the lobster roll. It is iconic to Maine, and people travel to Maine to hear this particular pipe organ. And Maine has many other wonderful pipe organs, but I think it's fair to say that the Kochmar is kind of the crown jewel of the many wonderful instruments we have here.
And David, what about in your world, in the world of repairing and building organs? Do people come to Maine to work with you from other parts of the country?
And the world. We have an organ in Belgium. We have an organ in Ontario, Canada. We have organs in Georgia, Indiana, Washington State, and numerous instruments around New England. So in this day and age of being able to put something up on our website, we catch people's attention and they come to us and say, "Can you do this for us?" And our most recent project, the one we have in the shop right now, 2 weeks ago, we took it out of St. Joseph's on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., loaded it into trucks and brought it here. And now it's packed into our shop and we're already well into the restoration of that instrument. The next instrument coming up.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. The next instrument. Tell me about the next instrument coming up.
I'll give that to Nick because.
Okay, go ahead, Nick.
So the next instrument after the restoration in Washington, D.C. is our Opus 81. So that's a brand new instrument that has 32 stops and two manuals. And it's for St. Stanislaus Church in Nashua, New Hampshire. So it's fairly local, and it'll be a good-sized instrument.
James, anybody who's been to one of your concerts knows that you get a workout when you play the organ. It is quite something if no one has ever been to a concert of James Kennerly's at Merrill Auditorium in Portland. What does it feel like to be doing that, to be so focused on the music, but also moving your arms and your legs? And I'm just trying, the whole time I watched, I was just trying to imagine what kind of zone you have to put yourself in to be able to play that beast.
Well, it's incredibly physical, as you say, because we have to use our hands and our feet. And of course, you know, when you're trying to balance yourself without your hands or your feet to help you, that's a real challenge. So first of all, it's a really good core strengthener. Forget those Pilates exercises. Just take the pipe organ and take some lessons, and that'll do it all for you. And then, of course, it's a mental workout because I'm using all of my hands, of course, the 10 digits there, and then the 2 feet, often doing different things, you know, going up and down, right and left at different times. And then in addition to that, we have to think about the music that we're playing, the notes that we're making up, or maybe we're improvising and making it all up from ourselves. And then we have to think about the sounds we're going to use, what we call the stops. Those are to my left and the right on the pipe organ. And so all of this stuff creates this sort of cataclysmic mental, physical exercise that I try not to think about.
I just try not to think about the music
and zone out and focus on making the audience have a really good time. And generally that works out pretty well.
That's funny. I've read that Simone Biles is not thinking when she's up in the air tumbling. So you guys have something in common. So if you're, how much practice to get to a point where you're not thinking about some extraordinary piece of music?
Well, it's funny you mentioned the, you know, Olympiad and really high-level professional sports, because that's the closest analogy that we have. But as organists, we have to practice for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day if we have a show coming up. And it's about that last nanosecond of perfection that makes our art such a wonderful thing, but such a difficult thing, because we have to keep it at that very high level. So as I joke, if I don't practice for one day, I know about it. If I don't practice for 2 days, the experts know about it. If I don't practice for 3 days, the audience knows about it. And that's a really good way of sort of explaining what it is to be an organist. And so I have to practice all the time.
If you're traveling, are you finding organs where you're going?
Believe it or not, yeah, I took a few days off last week. I say off in air quotes because I found a church where I was able to practice for a few hours a day, because we have a show coming up this July 13th. And so I wanted to keep my chops up. And so I found a few hours each day to go in there and practice.
Wow. Well, calling us now is Harold Stover, who is a concert organist who has performed internationally for 5 decades. He's also an educator and retired church organist. And before we welcome you, Harold, and before we ask you a couple questions, we'll hear a little clip of you playing the organ. Brava. Hi, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Jennifer. Good morning, listeners.
Tell us how you ended up becoming an organist.
Well, it was sort of a conversion experience back in my teenage years. I was taken to an organ recital, and when I walked into it, I was, to tell you the truth, more concerned with being able to play the piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. And when I walked out of the recital, I said to myself, that's what I want to do with my life. And that's what I've done.
Wow. And you're based in Southern Maine, right? Now, can people still hear you perform?
I'm actually calling you from the organ loft at the Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul in Lewiston, home of the largest church organ in Maine, and the organ that you just heard on that little clip of mine. And I'll be playing it tomorrow as part of the summer series here at the Basilica. There are concerts on Wednesdays at 12:15 all through July and into August.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Do you have a moment? Can you tell us about the organ at Lewiston? Does it have an interesting history?
It does, actually. It was built by the Cassavant Company, one of the great Canadian builders. And it was built in 1938. And like many large organs, it fell into disrepair in the 50s and 60s. And the first time I played it, which would have been in the early 90s, it was in quite bad shape. And I actually remember thinking, if this thing's working at all in another 6 months, it'll be a miracle. Well, miracles happen, And thanks to the persistence of Scott Valancourt, the organist here at the Basilica, and a supportive parish, it's come back to life, and it all works, and it's a glorious sound.
Well, I understand we have another clip of you playing, and we're going to hear that right now. Explain what we just heard.
I believe that was a piece by Alexander Guillemont, a great French organist of the late 19th century, one of the founders of the French Symphonic Organ School. And the Cassavant organ here is a great exponent of that romantic style.
Well, Harold Stover, thank you so much for calling in. We will have, you mentioned the concert series in Lewiston at the Basilica there, and we will, just so you know, put information about every concert series mentioned on today's Main Calling program on our website and Facebook page and in the newsletter that comes out every Friday. Harold Stover, thanks for calling in. Longtime concert organist, church organist, and educator. It's interesting to me, James, that Harold said that the piece he was just talking about was written in the 19th century, because my understanding is that there have been a couple sort of heydays of the organ, and one was obviously in Bach's day, and one is the 20th century. What was it about the 20th century that brought back the pipe organ?
Well, I think it was really four things that kind of intersected. People loved music. People still love music. That's great. People really wanted to give, and so there was a real sense of philanthropy. There was also a real sense of civic pride. People were proud of their cities, of their towns, of their buildings, and so they gave money to create wonderful buildings, train stations, concert halls, etc. And there was also this sense of American industry, and I think for us, the Kochmar organ is when all four of those things intersected, and they were all kind of at, you know, turn the dial up to 11, and so we have this extraordinary gift in 1912, from a publishing magnate, Cyrus Curtis, and he gave us the Kochmar Memorial Organ in memory of his music teacher, Herman Kochmar, hence the very difficult to spell name. And it was built by one of the great American organ companies, the Austin Organ Company, based in Hartford, Connecticut. They're still alive and kicking. And of course, it was given to the city of Portland. It was given to the people of Maine. This is not owned by us. It's not owned by me. This is owned by the people. It's the people's pipe organ. And really, from the beginning, this instrument and many pipe organs were meant to entertain the masses.
And David, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, from just to add a little technical perspective to that, at the beginning of the 20th century, electricity and pipe organs were mashed up, I guess would be today's terminology. And that allowed the instruments to become ever so much bigger than they had ever been before. So that really fostered a different style of music. You had grander scale performances and instruments on which to perform. They crossed a bridge from the mechanical action instrument, which is limited to what your fingers can push down with some assistance, but the electrical introduction, and here comes the argument, the electrical introduction really allowed pipe organs to become huge.
Wow. And so therefore, the Kochmar organ is introduced in 1912 after the introduction of electricity into the whole picture. Nick?
Oh, I just wanted to toe the line for mechanical action organs.
What do you mean by that? So for those of us who are not experts, what is a mechanical action organ? I have a vision of somebody with big bellows in a basement somewhere pumping.
Yes.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah.
Pretty accurate. So a mechanical action organ can operate completely without electricity. Now, there are large mechanical action concert hall organs. Worcester has Mechanics Hall, which is a large, very large, fully mechanical organ. And there are also many, you know, large French and English organs that functioned completely on by mechanical action. So there was already a precedent for large instruments, and electricity did allow for even larger and more spacious instruments. But
all
still,
right.
I always like to just kind
of
get in
there. Well, after all, it is the American way, right? To build a great big whatever it is. So anyway, we do have to go to a break. We're talking about pipe organs on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. Today's program is part of our series on passions and pastimes. And some people are certainly passionate about pipe organs and organ music. We have some of them with us today. My guests, David Wallace and Nick Wallace, senior and junior partners and father and son pipe organ builders with David E. Wallace and Company in Gorham. And James Kennerly, municipal organist for the Kochmar Organ, also a conductor and composer. Share your comments and questions. Are you a fan of organ music? Send a brief email, please, to talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go to the calls, James, I want to ask you about something. One thing I was struck by, I went to the Bachfest this past year, is the variety of ages in the auditorium. So exciting. And I'm wondering if this has been the case for your entire career, or if there's a bit of a I don't know what the word would be, a renaissance or a broadening of the appeal in the audience recently.
Yeah, I think that's something that I and the Friends of the Kochmar and some of my colleagues across the world have been trying to reinvigorate what the pipe organ is. A lot of us, as you said at the beginning, think that the organ belongs in church. It plays sad music for funerals or Halloween and stuff like that. And we're really trying to change that narrative, because this pipe organ is a concert organ. It was never meant to, you know, accompany hymns or play for weddings and stuff. It was meant to entertain people in the most exciting possible ways. So I think because we have really worked hard to change that narrative and to perform music that people wouldn't expect. I mean, we're really doing some gender bending here with a concert coming up on Saturday, which has bluegrass and ragtime and jazz and folk and shaker music. All these things you would not expect to hear on a pipe organ. And that has really registered with a lot of folks who are, you know, on the younger end of the scale, or they are on like the preteen end of the scale. And they really are invigorated by this amazing instrument and the music that we're able to produce on it.
Do you find that often people are dragged to their first concert, and then once they experience it, that's it, they're back?
Absolutely. They are hooked. And there is something about the organ, and I've been doing this for my entire career, I still haven't quite been able to manage to nail down exactly what that is, but there is something about the organ that is a visceral, sort of subliminal experience that moves people to tears. I mean, it is transformational in the extreme. And it's impossible to describe. The only way is to come and hear it for yourself. But a lot of people experience that. And seeing that for the first time is by far the best thing that I do in my career, just seeing that transformation.
David, you're laughing. It sounds like you have a story that fits right.
No, it just goes along with exactly what James was saying. My first introduction to the pipe organ, and in particular the Kochmar because of where we lived, was age 7. And here I am now approaching age 75, and I'm still involved with the Kochmar organ. It's very different than what I did when I was 7, but nonetheless, all these years later, and it's exactly as James said, there was that magic moment where it's like, wow, this is just awesome beyond description. And then it all went on from there.
Well, calling in now is Shireen Shahawi. She is past executive director with Friends of the Kochmar Organ and an organ music enthusiast. And with her is her young super fan of organ music, Shireen's granddaughter, Thea, who is 9 years old. Shireen, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you first and then Thea. Tell us how you became such a fan of organ music.
Well, it was really exciting to join the organization back in late 2018 for some project work, and then becoming the executive director in 2019. And I had lived in Portland since 1985 and had no clue what was behind that facade in Merrill Auditorium. And I remember David Wallace showing me around my first or second day with the organization, and the word gobsmacked comes to mind, because you get inside and get behind that facade and you realize just what a magnificent thing this is. And I mean, I'd lived in Portland for so many years and had always thought that the speaking pipes were those, you know, the ones on the front, not all the ones in the back. And learning about the antiphonal section up in the ceiling and realizing that we had surround sound in Merrill Auditorium without trying. So I think that's what made it fun. And then I have Thea today because I think she is James's biggest fan. I can't remember which concert we brought her to, but thoroughly hooked from when we did the Motor Booty Affair mashup to bringing her and the rest of our family to Christmas every year, to the kids programming. And she's my forever date to Kaczmar concerts. And she and I are all teed up to be there Saturday night and excited for it.
Well, so exciting. If you wouldn't mind, please put Thea on the phone. Thea, I want you to tell us what it is that you love so much about the Kaczmar organ and James Kennerly's organ performances.
I love how, like, there are different sounds, and there are, like, some unexpected ones, too. Like, the stops, as one of them, there's a car horn, but, like, there's, like, other sounds, like chimes, too, like you might expect. So I love how there are, like, different sounds, but there are also, like, normal sounds, and I just love how they, like, mix together to make that harmony of sounds.
Do you know anyone else your age who listens to organ music like you do?
I don't think so.
Well, tell me, do you want to learn how to play the organ, or are you happy just listening?
I'm just happy listening to it.
Yeah, it looks like quite a project to learn, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
If you have, well, because we have you here speaking to James, I want to ask you if you have any requests from him. What would you love to hear him play?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
It's okay if you don't. Thea. That's perfectly fine. Thank you so much for sharing with us, and say thank you to your grandma, Shireen.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We'll see you on Saturday, James.
See you guys.
Have a great day. Now on the line with us is Kevin Birch, who is director of music at St. John's Catholic Church in Bangor and director of the St. John's Organ Society, also on the music faculty at the University of Maine, teaching organ and harpsichord. So Kevin, thank you so much for calling in. Tell us about the kind of music you perform in Bangor.
Well, thank you for having me. I play on one of the great 19th century organs in New England. This is the E&GG Hook organ, Opus 288, which was built in 1860 for St. John's Catholic Church in Bangor. And we have an organ society which supports summer organ concerts, international organ concerts, and a good deal of outreach to schools and institutions. So we play a great variety of music on the instrument, not only myself, but many guest organists who come from all over the world, really, to come and enjoy performing on this instrument.
And what is significant about the organ at St. John's?
Well, compared, for example, to the Kaczmar organ, it's about a half century older, and it represents the very high level of New England organ building in the middle of the 19th century. This was a kind of a watershed time for the development of the organ in the United States. In New England, organs had been patterned after English instruments, but by the middle of the 19th century, there were influences from continental organs, particularly in Germany and France. And these design elements found their way into the New England organ building tradition. And the instrument in Bangor is a wonderful example of a large instrument that is both rooted in the past, but also trending toward developments which would continue through the 19th century. So it's a very special articulation point in the history of the organ in New England.
Great. And Kevin, I want to talk to you about your students at the University of Maine. Do you think that the future of organ music and organ performance is alive and well based on your students?
I would say yes, and not only through the University of Maine, but we have supported scholarships for young students between St. John's Organ Society and the Bangor chapter of the American Guild of Organists. Just this past year, we have two students finishing their doctorates, and they will be important colleagues in our profession. And many students who are serving in churches and teaching all around the country. I think there's a wonderful future for the organ. We have to just keep reminding our youngsters how wonderful it is to study and play on the instrument.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for calling in. Kevin Birch with St. John's Church, who also teaches organ at the University of Maine. And now calling in my colleague, Sarah Tuttle with Maine Public Classical. Sarah, you don't play the organ, but I understand you are performing with James on Saturday, or at least if I don't know it, if you do.
Hi, Jen. It's nice to be talking about this with you this morning. I am indeed taking part in Saturday evening's concert. I'll be singing some songs alongside James and Mia in the concert program.
Well, I want to ask you, Sarah, what is it like to try to sing along with an organ? I mean, you've got pipes, but you don't have pipes like the Kochmar organ.
Very true. Very, very true. It's quite a luxurious experience. As Thea observed a couple minutes ago, there are all of these beautiful colors that come into play with the organ. And, you know, as you've observed, I'm sure James's enthusiasm and passion for the instrument is contagious. So it's a real pleasure to be making this music in this space.
The show is called Fiddles and Pipes. What will you be singing?
I will be performing a couple of the old American songs arranged by American composer Aaron Copland. You'll hear a Shaker hymn and a revivalist hymn, and I'll also be including an arrangement of Wayfaring Stranger, a beloved folk song arranged and collected by John Jacob Niles. So I think it'll be a nice color contrast.
Well, thanks for taking some time to call in, Sarah Tuttle. You recognize her name and her voice from Maine Public Classical. James, before we move on, is there anything you want to add about what it's like for you to play along with a vocalist?
Well, you know, the pipe organ is a one-person band, as I sort of implied earlier, because we have all of these sounds that sort of imitate instruments of the orchestra. We have percussion instruments, we have marimbas and xylophones, and as Thea mentioned, we have toy stops like doorbells and bird whistles and things. No birds were harmed in the making of this sound, I should say. So the organist is used to playing without anybody else. You know, we don't need anyone, which, of course, I'm saying facetiously here, because we love to collaborate with people. And I really can't wait to perform with Sarah in particular, because she has such a wonderful, remarkably warm voice, as you can hear in her spoken voice. Her singing voice is much like that. But I'm going to have to keep the organ slightly at bay. I'm going to have to tone her down a little bit, the organ, not Sarah, because the sounds, of course, can be really overwhelming. I want to make sure I find those really delicate sounds that will work with Sarah's voice.
We're going to go to Graham, who's calling from Scarborough. Hi, Graham. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm sitting in front of a Mason and Hamlin Organ Company organ, and this is like about the size of an upright piano. It has 9 stops. It looks like it's made of either mahogany or walnut. I'm not certain about it. It's got some writing. It's got 9 stops on it. It's got a bunch of what I'm going to guess and say are decals, but they look like they might be gold leaf or something, saying Paris 1878, Sweden 1878, Philadelphia 1876. Santiago, 1875, Vienna, 1873, Paris, 1867, I think.
Graham, do you have a bit of a puzzle on your hand? Are you trying to figure out some more information about your organ?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, David.
I'm sorry, Graham, to cut in. This is David Wallace. Look to the left-hand side of that same nameplate. Does it say Mason and Hamlin, or does it say Esty?
Yes, no, it says right in the middle, it says Mason and Hamlin Organ Company.
Okay, it's a Mason and Hamlin reed organ. One manual or two?
I don't understand the question.
One keyboard or two keyboards?
one keyboard, two pedals.
Okay. Okay. Yep.
I presume it's a pipe organ.
No, it's a reed organ. Probably built in the 1870s, 1880s.
Well, forgive me.
That's great, Graham. But let's quickly, if you could explain, David, what's the difference between a reed organ and a pipe organ?
Reed organs were built for much smaller venues. People had in the latter part of the 19th century would have reed organs in their home. It was an alternative to a piano, but it makes it sound by a little reed, very similar to the reeds that are in harmonicas and or accordions. Unlike a pipe organ, which has a set of whistles, the reed organ has a set of reeds. So it's a harmonica on steroids.
There you go, Graham. There's your answer. We do need to take another quick break. And you are listening to Maine Calling. As we go to this break, we will listen to a clip of two world-class organists playing two special organs. And we're going to learn more about this when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're learning about pipe organs and organ music as part of our Passions and Pastimes series. My guest, James Kennerly, municipal organist for the Kochmar Organ, and so much more. And David Wallace and Nick Wallace, father and son, pipe organ builders right here in Maine. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. If you're really fast, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. David, before we go back to more callers, tell us about the music we heard before we went to break. Who was playing and what's significant about the organs we heard?
It was music from Eastman School of Music played at Christ Church in downtown Rochester, New York. It was Dr. Ann Laver and Dr. David Higgs. The recording was done back during the pandemic, so there was no audience that night. The two organs they have in the church in the rear gallery is a recreation of an 18th century organ that the original instrument exists in Latvia, and a copy of it was made for the Eastman School of Music and put in the church. A number of years later, we restored an organ that used to be in St. Dominic's Church in Portland, Maine, as their 19th century example of their 19th century Boston built organs. And we installed that in the chancel part of the church. And both instruments probably get 40 to 50 hours of use a week for student recitals, practice, and things like that. Plus, both instruments are used for church services on Sunday. But an outstanding comparison of 18th and 19th century instruments.
Mm. On the line with us now, Caitlin Emerson, an organist and educator. Originally from Maine and currently teaching in Toronto, she is a PhD candidate at the University of Cambridge in England. Thanks so much for calling in, Caitlin. And I have to ask you, what got you interested in playing the organ?
Sure. Well, it's a delight to be here with you. As you said, I'm currently in Toronto, so hopefully the phone connection stays pretty stable. There's actually currently a wonderful scholarship program just south of the Maine New Hampshire border in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, started at St. John's Episcopal Church there in Portsmouth. And they have an extraordinary program that offers scholarships to anybody who's interested in learning the pipe organ, especially high school students. They were started in 2001 with a bit of seed money from the Episcopal Bishop, even though it's attached to the church there. It's not necessarily a sacred organization. It's really about passion for the instruments and getting young people interested in it. And I was very lucky to win one of those scholarships, and that got me started first with lessons at the organist of the church there, Abby Halberg Siegfried. And then after 1 year of study, I began working with Ray Cornils up at the Kochmar, who also at that time was organist in First Parish Church of Brunswick, Maine. So I was making the trek up from York all the way to Portland and Brunswick every other week all the way through high school to have lessons with Ray.
Well, you know, it seems to me that most organists are men. Is that true? And has that affected your experience throughout your education and career?
It's a really interesting thing. I never really noticed growing up, and it's intriguing how once you kind of enter into the world more professionally, people bring your attention more to gender and to age and these important inclusivity factors. I mean, you could also argue that most organists are somewhat Anglo-Saxon too. So we do need to be very conscious about inclusivity and making sure that people feel a part of the community, no matter their socioeconomic, cultural, linguistic backgrounds, any of these important factors. Being a woman has not been consciously part of my learning of the pipe organ, and I've felt very much privileged to be part of that world, no matter who is part of it.
Caitlin, before I go, I just want to ask you, when you play the organ for an audience, what is it you're hoping to impart? What are you hoping people come away with?
Well, I would hope that anybody playing music for a profession or for the joy of it as a pastime, as you say, would be wanting to take people on a journey and helping them to process these wonderful sounds that we're making in such ways that it brings them on an emotional journey or some kind of trip, musical traveling, I often like to call it. So I guess just taking them with me on a tour of the piece, on a tour of the instruments, and hopefully bring a little bit of joy or a little bit of poignancy to their life, to their afternoon or evening in the concert.
Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for calling in. And before we go, I'm going to have David Wallace. He wants to say something to you. Go ahead, David.
Good to hear you, Caitlin. But what I wanted to add was that the group that Caitlin was talking about at the beginning of conversation is the Young Organist Collaborative in Portsmouth, is the actual name of the organization. And they've done wonderful things. And Nick served on the board of directors there for 6 years and helped them really get the program moving. So wonderful to hear from you, Caitlin.
Wonderful. Caitlin Emerson performs and teaches organ and is studying for her PhD at the University of Cambridge. Let's see here. We got David calling from Kittery Point. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi there. My name is David Gibson. I'm retired organ builder. My firm was Bozeman Gibson and Company out of Deerfield, New Hampshire. And this has been so delightful to hear about these organs because my firm in 1981 did the restoration of the EJ&G Hook at St. John's in Bangor. We also restored a mechanical action organ at in the First Church in Belfast, Maine, and we put in a new instrument in the chapel on Squirrel Island. So we have quite a bit of history here with Maine, and now I'm retired and get to just listen. So,
David, thank you so much for calling in. I think Nick Wallace wants to say something.
Hi, David. It's great to hear from you. And I have recently seen all those instruments, and they're doing quite well. It's lovely to see your work out on Squirrel Island.
Yeah, Squirrel Island is a great one to go and visit. I've taken my whole family out there a few times, and we've managed to get someone to come perform for us. I got into organ building because I loved it so very much, but playing it is not a talent that I have. So the way I could be associated, my partner, George Bozeman, is quite a wonderful performer, and so he worked that end of it, and I worked the engineering end of it. So,
sounds like a perfect pairing. David, thank you so much for calling in. David calling in from Kittery Point. We have an email here from Pat. Shout out to the original Chicago Blackhawks arena that had the pipe organ built into the ceiling. So that sounds wow, lucky people in Chicago there. We're going to go to Ann calling from Saco. Hi, Ann, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share that we have a beautiful old two-manual organ in the Unitarian Universalist Church in Saco. It's a pipe organ, and you can crawl behind it and see where they used to have boys pumping the bellows many years ago. And it's got full, I don't know how many octaves of foot pedals. But in it, what I wanted to say is that it's wonderful to hear the soft clacking of the pedals when the organist plays the hymns. It just really takes me back.
Anne, thank you so much. And James, talk about that soft clacking of the pedals. Are you working that into the performance? Or are you trying to be quiet? What's going on?
Well, to play the organ, we have to wear these special shoes, kind of like pixie shoes, which have an extended heel and a very kind of soft area under your toe, because when you play, you use the front of your foot, the toes, and the back of your foot, the heel. And so you kind of rock your feet around, and it's quite a dance that you can see. For our shows, we have a great big Megatron screen so that we can see that. The audience members can see all of that detail up close. But yeah, there's a little bit of clicking and clacking. We generally try. My organ teacher used to say you should be able to put a glass of water on your hand while you're playing, and of course the water should not spill. So the idea is that you're so still and so calm, even though the music is so fast and frenetic. And so I always keep that image in my mind for my hands and for my feet. And the organ does make a little bit of clicking, a little bit of clacking. Generally, the sounds that it makes, you know, the sounds we want it to make, at least, will cover up all of that mechanical noise.
Anne, thank you. And I want to ask you, James, how would a young person learning musical instruments have a sense that they might be a good organist? I'm guessing that there's a little more to it than there is for some other instruments. How do you know? How does a teacher say, okay, here's one, this one will be, has the potential?
Well, I think the first thing is people hearing the pipe organ. And one of the things we do with the Friends of the Kochmar is backstage pipe tours, which is a name actually that my wife came up with, because our audience members come on stage in Merrill Auditorium. We demonstrate the organ, we perform, and then they go inside it. And this organ was built not expressly so people could tour through it, but actually so people like David and Nick could go in and fix it while it's running. So you can actually stand inside the Kochmar organ while it's being played, and like standing under the hood of a car and fixing things that need to be adjusted. But we twisted that around, we innovated, and we decided to bring people inside the organ to tour it. So yesterday we had two tours. One of them was specifically for young people, and I had three people come up and say, well, I want to learn the organ. So I think, number one, we have to show them the pipe organ. We have to tell them how amazing it is. And then we have to get them access to practice instruments. Sometimes you have to be a certain height so your feet reach the pedals. That's how I didn't learn until I was about 12, 13, 14, because I just wasn't tall enough. And you have to get a certain level of proficiency with your fingers. So generally, we'll study the piano for a few years, maybe an instrument like the violin, maybe some singing. And so you have a really good musical background, because the organ is not for the faint of heart. And so it's good to kind of build up those skills before you actually start learning.
Okay, we are almost out of time, but I just have to ask you, David, in your years of repairing and renovating organs, what is the most bizarre thing that you found? What is the story that you tell at dinner parties?
Oh, wow. I mean, Jennifer, that is, that's probably chapter 7 in my book. Whenever that gets written, there are so many different stories of magical things. I think since the Kochmar has been kind of the focal point here today, I can tell a real quick story about the magnificence of the instrument and its simplicity and getting into repair it, as James just mentioned. One time during a Ray Cornelius Christmas concert, a note stuck. One pipe kept on playing and playing and playing. So Nick and I very quickly got up, went around, went inside the air box. We could go inside the pressure part, found the pipe that was offending. And as Ray was introducing his next piece to the audience, once the audience started clapping, we quickly took out the bad part, put in the new part, and sealed it shut and went out and sat down. And Ray just kind of looked back, a little glance from the organ bench to let us know that he knew that we fixed that while he was talking to the audience.
I love it. I love it. Well, I so appreciate it. I'm going to wrap up really quickly so we can hear a little more music. Thank you all for joining us. Who you just heard, David Wallace, he and his son Nick Wallace, also with us, junior and senior partners, father and son, pipe organ builders with David E. Wallace and Company, and James Kennerly, the municipal organist for the Kochmar Organ, and also a conductor, composer, and vocalist. Today's sound engineer, Jane Donahue, Maine Calling, produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn, here on Maine Public Radio.